Yeah, we need to actually.
What, Spotify Wrapped?
Yeah, and see who the fuck's actually listening to us.
Do we even have like a Spotify account? No, we don't. Like,
we even have a review now. We're 4.3. So please rate
out
us.
Out of 5?
Yeah.
That's not bad.
How many reviews you got?
1. It's you 2. And
no, ratings? No, quite a bit.
How many?
Well, the people rated it?
Yeah.
Like 50. Don't
send me. It's not a book club podcast.
It's not a book club podcast.
It's not a book club.
It's not a book club podcast.
It's not a book club podcast at all. Nah.
Yeah, so we're here. It's not a book club podcast.
Oh, don't conform.
Bruv.
Don't conform to his rules.
No, but bro, we need to introduce it.
Do you know how disjointed this entrance is now? Like, we've had about...
Oh, okay.
It's a mess. This is what happens when you don't drink Japanese whiskey.
Whatever.
Wait, did you not drink it?
I am.
Oh, okay, so
there's
some.
There's more there.
This podcast is sponsored by Suntory Yamazaki whiskey. Okay, cool. So, Yukio Mishima, The Temple of the Golden Pavilion. It's a novel by Yukio Mishima, a Japanese actor, playwright, bodybuilder. Samurai, poet,
many things,
a man of many things, a man who also committed seppuku on himself, at like, I think he was in his 30s, late 30s,
I think 32.
32, yeah, interesting. But he also wrote 50 volumes of works,
which kind of is very suspicious. Died. It's given Shakespeare, like someone had a writer, he had someone writing for him because he's young, and I mean,
he's a bit of a
maybe because we're just too busy nowadays.
Prodigy,
no? Doing nothing. What does that mean?
Prodigy, like he'd been,
he'd been
doing things from early. Like he wrote, I think he wrote his first novel, no, the second novel that gave him like quite big acclaim around 24. So. Interesting guy. But yeah, so this book basically chronicles the story, which actually is a true story, based on the story of a monk around just after World War II who set fire to this golden temple in
Spoiler
Japan.
Spoiler alert,
No, but it's actually a true story. So this, this actually happened. And
it probably wasn't the first time, though.
Yeah, it wasn't the first time, but he set fire to this temple. And then what happened was Yukio Mishima, he went and interviewed him in prison, got a bit of context about why he did it, got into his psyche and stuff, and then just kind of took that and then, because this is definitely a work of fiction, it's not directly a sort of note for note.
Yeah, it feels like both.
Recreation of what his thing is, but he uses that loosely to kind of chart this novel where he speaks about this acolyte at a temple and his ultimate turmoil with himself, his masculinity, his idea of beauty, and
his disability,
his
or disability. Inability, or whatever you want to call it, because he had a stutter,
exactly,
which the book interestingly didn't portray in the
writing, what's the right word for it? Well, he wouldn't
in the dialogue.
But he would
phonetically, like was, how you read it.
In the dialogue, they didn't present him as a stutter.
But the book is written in first person through his thoughts.
I know, right? So, but I think, I mean, there's lots to set there. But I'm just trying to say, like, the book doesn't stutter the words when he speaks.
I think it would have been too literal if they did that.
Maybe, but I think maybe there's deep, something deeper about that.
I'm not gonna lie, any authors that do that don't fall into that trap.
Bravi, we did. What was that book we read? Crooked Orange. Was it not another language?
Yeah, but he wasn't stuttering. It was done.
And
on
also
that,
the one about the mouse.
Okay. What? No.
The flowers of Algernon. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, don't, I'm thinking this is intentional, guys.
This book exists. I feel like it exists largely in the character's head. Like, there's so much of this 100%. Book which is just.
That's a good point.
Introspection. And I also wanted to touch on that actually, because the opening of the book for me was one of the most accurate and beautiful descriptions of what it feels like to have an impediment with your speech. Because when I was younger, I had quite a bad stutter where I think I was like 5 or 6. I went to this place called Michael Palin Center, where they kind of helped to...
You're disabled.
I am disabled. There you go. Moment of vulnerability.
Does this make us allies?
It does.
I didn't know you're disabled.
Yeah, yeah. So...
I'm joking.
Yeah. You're disabled. But just on that point, how he describes the... this place of having more things in your brain than what you can actually say.
Mm.
And the way that moments almost like disintegrate in front of you because your mind and your verbal ability is like in two different places. Mm. It was incredible because like I had to spend a lot of time like reading out loud, getting used to actually saying words and getting words in my mouth so that I could be able to communicate. And that was something that probably from like age 5 to about 12, I had to like do almost every day.
Does it still come out now?
Yeah, like it, I would say in small ways where I wouldn't say on a day-to-day basis is something that's like hampers me, because I've met some people that really had a bad start that didn't have that same level of control. I don't remember in sixth form, there was that girl who couldn't speak pretty much at all.
What's her name?
Chantel.
Chantel. One of the best singers. No, she's the best singer.
One of the best singers I've ever had in my life.
Honestly.
And you know what's about? She couldn't really speak that well, but she could sing and not one...
Flawless.
Not one
song. I try and find her tracks. She was... She had it. I
didn't have it on my hard drive.
It broke my heart that she just didn't carry... Like...
Damn. She was incredible.
Enchanting. It was incredible. Man. Yeah.
But just on that, like I think I could definitely relate immediately to that. Phrase that he put it in terms of, yeah, just the desecration of moments and also impatience of people. Because mine wasn't that bad. People I've seen who have got older and not really dealt with it, and it's almost like it can either make you super reserved, or it can, or it can just change your character because you basically live in your head rather than.
Do you think that was an influence too? Because obviously, he was it Mizuguchi. Mm. He becomes very disturbed.
Yeah, 100%.
And he uses that almost as like an as justification for becoming a bit disturbed.
Yeah,
and I did a slight little read before this, and I didn't because. As I was reading the book, with the stammer and that being a central thesis of this book, and he being a bit jaded by that, and then it just deteriorating his mental health, seeing the world quite negatively, but then it was a bit skewed, and it felt like I felt very uncomfortable reading the book throughout.
Yeah. Yeah, same.
It felt like I was peering into the mind of someone who was very mentally ill, and looking at reading it, he said it had schizophrenia and all of this stuff. I was like, okay, that makes sense. But it was also beautifully written in the sense of that, oh wow, is this what it's like to see this world in this way? And like constantly from a young child, just you seeing beauty in things that other people don't see beauty in, and then like how you justify certain behaviors. It makes sense, but it leaves you incredibly uncomfortable. But he uses a stammer as a justification for that. Oh, people don't see me. It's annoying, blah, blah. I can't really express myself. And then he curses his neighbor, that girl. And then...
Let's talk about that, because I remember when... Because he describes her and he knows so much about her, right? And because maybe it's the context of the neighborhood.
But who?
But his neighbor, one he's cycling home from work. She's worked at the hospital, and she's cycling home, and he sees her, and he steps onto the middle of the road, and he scares her, and she's just like, "Oh, what the she's like, "What the fuck? Like, oh, it's you. What were you doing here?" And he's kind of like, he just stands there, but he describes the kind of dialogue as if like she sees him. She witnesses him, and she's kind of like shocked by him, and just cycles off. And he's like, "Oh yeah, fuck that bitch." Basically, like he's really quite angry about like the fact that she didn't engage or communicate with him, but he didn't communicate with her. And the fact that she worked in a nursing home, and then she ended up getting pregnant by I think it was either American soldier or by I think they used the word neighbor.
Yeah, it was a Japanese soldier that deserted.
It was a deserter, sorry, yeah. So they said a deserter came to town and they found out the deserter actually got her pregnant. And then everyone shunned her, but then he talks about how it reaffirmed his kind of hatred for her a little bit. But he also kind of felt sorry for her.
This is odd.
But it's like, what I was going to say, this book about communication, right? Like, his inability to communicate has made him see, like, you, I think what you're saying about his perspective and things is kind of, I wouldn't say warped because I'm not, like, it's his perspective, but, like, it kind of made him see the world in a different way. And the way he sees beauty is not one which somebody owns. It's like something that kind of you don't own it, it just happens to you. And for this, for example, this stutter for him was a disability, or I think the word they used the word like it was I can't remember what they used the word for, but it basically made him unable to kind of communicate with people. But essentially beauty for him was an accident. That you had it, you didn't. And for his case, didn't have it. So that's why he kind of had this longing for it. And that's why sometimes I'm reading the book and each next paragraph is like, oh, the beauty of the pavilion. I'm just like, this obsession with beauty is also kind of...
Just on that one point, though...
It's kind of interesting.
Where you say about... how he frames his inability to talk and all the things that are in his head. I think it is also a genius plot device from the author to basically set up a character where he's got this inability to speak, but a very profound inability to think.
Yeah.
And so when you're reading the book, which is in first person, you're basically just getting the full clip of his mind in all of its glory, inglory, whatever you think. Because what this book does well, I think, is doesn't really give much of a moral judgment on what he thinks. Like, it's not like it says, oh, these things are bad, these things are good. It's almost like...
It just happens.
He just... Rolling. You just hear him say really despicable things. You're like, right, this guy's a fucking weirdo. But then there's not the typical moralistic, like, third person judgment on those actions. It's just you.
But is there ever with your own internal monologue? Not everyone has an internal monologue. No, but
the
author
could do that if they stepped outside of the first person point of view.
Would you say that again?
So if the author wanted to give a sort of moralistic third person point of view on what he's doing, he could step outside of being that character and speak as if he's observing this character. But all that we get is we're like locked in this first person view, which only gives us a very broad scope of his mind, but only his mind, which rationalizes very irrational to us anyway, as Western people. Because also have to consider, like, this is not a Western...
It's a translation book. Too.
It's a translation, but it's a different structure of moral hierarchy that we don't really apply.
I was going to say, because, like, culturally speaking, like, from Japan, like, from Kyoto, where he's from, spiritually, you're talking about another religion. Like, when it comes to Christianity, it's judgment. It's, like, good and bad, black and white. And, like, when it comes down to it, and like, church and stuff, when it comes to, like we were saying, like, judgment and, like, actions, there's consequences, right? But I think, and you can argue, I think one definitely translation, because I was reading it, I was thinking, I felt a bit weird. Like, that moment felt a bit, was that translated properly? But I think at the same time, it was like, this is coming from a completely different context. Like, they're not seeing it from, because the thing is, when I started reading this book, I was like, oh, this ain't matching Baldwin right now. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't lie to you. I was reading it at first, I was thinking, oh, it's not matching Baldwin's kind of, because Baldwin had a rhythm. And that's what, I guess that's what we're used to, whether it's in English or whatever, the stuff we read and music. But this is like, this has a consistent rhythm. Because when I was reading, I was like, it didn't really dip. Like, there wasn't many paragraphs that kind of lost me. It's very consistently well written. It's just like, it has a pace to it, which is kind of streams, that kind of goes like a stream. It just goes, it's just going. And when there's really bad moments, it doesn't pause on it. It kind of continues, which is quite nice. Well, I learned to appreciate towards the end anyway, when we got to like chapter 8, which is a bit late, but it's fine. But I think my point is like, we have to remember the context is completely different, spiritually, philosophy.
Yeah.
And that's probably why there's no, you say, judgment, there's no like moral pauses in these moments, because even the moment when he found out that his friend actually committed suicide, it almost felt like, because they didn't really dwell on the point, like if it was like someone committed suicide in a Baldwin book or something, it would have been like, oh, who would have known the torment he was going through, and they might have put a number in there for call helpline. You know, do you know what I mean? But like this one, it just kept going because it's like
part of
this is the reality. This is
part of the culture in some sense as well.
It's the human experience. Maybe it's like, I don't know how, I think there's so much wider reading that's required to fully understand that kind of way of thinking.
I think just on it's that interesting point, listening to you, because I think I'm just, how I found the book was, I was just very confused. For I didn't, when you said, oh, I'm going to, Temple of the Golden Pavilion, I think I had this idea of what this book was going to be like. And I started reading it and I was like, oh, this is not what I had initially thought. And then I kept going. I was like, oh, this is really odd. And so this makes me feel uncomfortable. So I generally don't know what I feel towards this book. I didn't really have an opinion about the book. Even really now, I feel like I'm just going to listen to you guys because I'm still trying to, this is the most novel book in terms of, I've never read or come across a book like this ever before. No, and I'd be interested to hear what you guys think. Have you ever come across a book like this?
The whole thing, or did you listen to audiobook? Was it half and half? How did you experience the book?
Audiobook.
You read the whole thing and then you listened to all the
No, I read a quarter of it and listened to audiobook.
Like the beginning or the end?
Beginning.
And then
read a bit in the middle and then listened to the audiobook for the end. I thought the ending was weird too.
I did half and half.
I thought he was going to kill himself. He didn't kill himself.
But why was it confusing, do you think? Have you deciphered it yet, or are you just still?
That's why I really want to hear what you got, because it takes a lot for me to get stumped, like as if I just chat about anything, as you guys know.
Agreed. Yeah.
But in a sense that I don't even know if it was a good book or bad book. Like I was like reading it. I was like, oh, this is not what I intended for. What I initially thought it was going to be like. In the middle, I was like, oh, this is a bit odd. I don't know where the hell it's going. I was like, what's the narrative? What is it supposed to be portraying? I was like, okay, it's portraying this. I was like, oh, no, it's portraying this. I was like, oh, maybe it's portraying both. And then it ends. I'm like, okay. I was like, oh, that was very uncomfortable. Yeah. I don't know if that was good. I can see why it's a classic, but it just makes me feel uncomfortable. Then and it reminds me, I think, of a similar book that I was going to maybe used reading on the podcast was Lolita, and I've heard it's very similarly written, where it captures this the mindset from first person of a person that effectively falls in love with a 12-year-old from a paedophile's perspective, right? And it makes you feel very uncomfortable reading it, and this book is very similar to that, but just from a different perspective, where it chronicles mental health, schizophrenia. I personally think like the mind in what we call in modern day an incel, where it's very someone's who has this level of self hatred and loathes.
But can we?
And then it's like it's very odd. Like that's why I just kind of want to listen to what you guys think. But I don't know what I think about this book.
I'll let Zach kind of. But I'm gonna say something quickly because I feel like Zach maybe has a better like a larger kind of summary. But I feel like the way you kind of described this thing was that you're almost kind of trying to explain the book as you're reading it. Because I was doing the same thing at first. When I started reading it, like I said, the pace of it, I realized, was not changing.
Yes.
And so it frustrated me because I was thinking, especially when you come from, we were at Giovanni's room, and it was like, it gave you stuff. It gave you stuff on the way, like little nuggets and treats, and there's stuff to dissect, there's stuff to symbolism and blah, blah, blah. And this book wasn't really doing that for you. And it's like, and it's feeding you all this stuff, which technically could have been way shorter. But at the same time, I feel like if he didn't have all that stuff, he wouldn't have been the book that it is. And I feel like you needed to hear that. And I feel like it's very easy for anyone to write. It's easy for a writer to portray a character as sane and like collected and curated. And in a way, this book felt as if, that's what I was saying at the beginning. Like he didn't, he mentioned the book loads of times that he's a stutter and he started in this time. And he had a friend that had a limp, and he used a limp to basically sleep with women, and he was a bit of a prick, to be honest, but he didn't like try to label anybody. He just kind of said, this is the life of like of people, and if you have a sister, this is what you could be around, and this is what you are in a way. But he doesn't try to label, doesn't try to condemn, doesn't try to judge. And don't get me wrong, this person is unable to communicate, and like Zach was saying, his mental state in a way to some was more versed and maybe more grown than others, but because of that it probably deteriorated much quicker than it should have. Do you know what I mean? And there's one quote that there's loads of quotes in the book that I thought was beautiful, but like the part I was saying about how he was unable to feel beautiful inside and out, right? And that's why he kind of obsessed over this temple, this architecture, and he's always talking about it. But there's a part where he says, because although beauty may give itself to everyone, it does not actually belong to anybody. And like it reminds me of like when he's sleeping, well, he finds out that the main guy the temple was basically sleeping and with women, like paying for money, yeah, and like drinking alcohol. Apparently, like, and there's like this the idea of like
passed off.
Yeah, like, even like when the soldier stepped on, he told him to step on a woman's stomach or something. Like these kind of moments for him was just, I don't know, him just living a life that existed at the time. Do you know what I mean? Like he can't.
But also, like I think it's important to mention that he was okay. Even though we're kind of given the perspective of this guy who I think,
yeah,
we can come to the conclusion that he's
mentally ill, man.
He's abnormal.
He's just a normal guy.
Even compared to the club-footed guy who's a fucking piece of shit.
Yeah.
He even says, "Nah, man, you're weird. Like you're a weird guy." Yeah. He even says that to him when I'm trying to think of what exactly happened, but towards the end, he kind of says to him, "Nah, you're."
What? Because he jazzed his loan.
You're
bro.
A strange person.
He took his money and just.
And I feel like even. In the context of what is his like university, his preschool, whatever thing, he's an outcast. Like yeah. We don't get to see it that much, but he's an outcast who tries to find another outcast and make a friend out of that person. And the one person that he does meet that was perhaps pure or more moralistically pure, which was Terzakawa, a guy that killed himself.
Mm.
Got run over by a thing, but actually killed himself. He basically ended up alienating him because he had this weird relationship with like doing dark things, and that would give him some kind of satisfaction that he could explore more with this club-footed guy who was more kind of into bringing him into this kind of darker side of himself, whereas Terzakawa, who was more honourable. He sort of pushed him away as he became more friends with this club-footed guy. And that, for me, represented him taking that turn where it's like, okay, he starts to explore what it means to be evil or what it means to be evil for the sake of being evil, not for necessarily him being intrinsically evil, but this whole weird concept of him choosing to explore a part of himself that is kind of dormant and is there because we see it in moments when he's talking about different things with him not being able to speak and da da da, but he's given a physical embodiment of.
Do you think
a
he was
person
evil?
That he can explore evil with through the club-footed guy, and he kind of does that, and it's almost like it's like a plot device where it's like okay, cool, because from that point you start to see him do more and more. Despicable things but and he enjoy found, it.
Weird. Do you think he was evil then?
No, but before we judge that, I was going to say, what I find interesting is that the bad stuff, he found beauty in it. He found it.
That's what I'm saying.
His perspective on stuff was, you can say it's warped or whatever, but like his perspective on stuff was like, beauty entails everything in a way. He's like, beauty entails that beauty tells him that he's not beautiful, but that he is. And like, I think for him, the temple being on fire was a beautiful thing because although it's on fire and it's like fire is a bad thing and it's whatever, he sees it as a good thing. And that's what I'm trying to say. Like,
why do you think he sees it as a good thing?
Because he saw, so there's many reasons why he burnt it down, right? And why he said, I'm gonna, when he made that decision, he almost pronounced it in the book. I've heard it here. It's like, when the golden temple has been burned down, yes, when the golden temple has been burned, the world of these fellows will be transformed. The golden rule of their lives will be turned upside down.
He's pitching him like, ha ha.
Do you know what I mean? And like, and when he burns it down, he goes and sits on top of the hill and smokes.
What did you give? I didn't understand that.
Okay, I'll say this now. Yeah, when I was reading the book, I was like, I think it got to page like 40 something, and I was like, I have to write this out, and I have to kind of write it out in a way where I don't expect anything. I can't expect anything.
Honestly, I didn't actually enjoy reading the book. But
like I said, I message you guys.
I enjoyed the book.
Finally got better.
No, it's weird. So I enjoyed the echo of the book in me after I read it.
What do you mean by that?
As in, like, I enjoyed after reading it and then sitting with it and being like, okay, what have I just experienced? It's almost like I'm going to a show, like. When you first listen to like free jazz, when it's all like everyone's just playing, and then after you're like, okay, cool, there's something there for me to take. I didn't actually enjoy the day to day of reading the book in terms of how it's written. It's very dense. It's very like he'll move like from different tangents so quick. Like 1 minute he's talking about one thing, next thing he's jumped somewhere else, and he's like talking about what the like he'll like extrapolate meaning out of very simple, normal things, and then almost like rant about how he's basically looking at a normal scenario, and then he'll zoom out of that and talk about how the world
like the fly on the tea
is just the
you keep going on the fly on the tea.
It's just super. It's bro, super
it, it was actually a very good paragraph, well written. I have to say, like when he meets the woman that he goes to have sex with, and he's like, "Oh, she like her." Breast jiggled, and then it's like a fly went on it, and she didn't flinch, she didn't move, and the fly rested there. And I was thinking, there's a lot of meaning in this, but I need to carry on reading.
I think this is actually one of the most beautiful books that we've read.
But at the same time, I don't want to be, as a Western viewer, like I said, right, in school, we're drilled in symbolism and proportions and how a post is meant to have like quarters and this and. You know, in Shakespeare, when he says this, he actually means that. Like, so I don't want to read this book and try and extrapolate too much, because then the book, although it's fiction, I don't want to now fictionalize it even more. But the point is with this book, I think some stuff is very direct and some stuff can be subliminal, which is fine. But I don't want to, like I said, I feel there's so much more wider reading around the book that's required to fully understand the book. And it's like, you know, when you speak another language, you just understand it better. I think this is what the book is. It's
and like, just for context as well, he was kind of a Japanese like loyalist, so he basically was on the principles where the emperor was like god,
and
he was on that stuff, so he was actually anti everything really the
and that's why, you know, the book, because when I found out afterwards about him as a like being a bodybuilder later on in life and killing himself and like, There's so many nods to this in the book. And for example, like him, when I found out he's like is pro Japan, like he's so pro Japan, like he was like upset when they lost the war, and that's why they brought up the Korean War, and this was like, it's not the same thing, but they basically went through the war with the USA. Anyways, when I found out about that, I was thinking, yo, like there's so many parallels. And for him, burning the temple down was like, for him, the temple was something that was surrounded by a building, surrounded by monks, surrounded by people, surrounded by a village, an ecosystem of Japanese people, right? And now it's become this, because apparently it got burnt down before. No, sorry, it got burnt down before ages ago, but it survived the war because Kyoto wasn't bombed. And if you watch Oppenheimer, they say, "Oh, we don't gonna bomb Japan because one of the dons went to Kyoto," and like it's known universally or internationally as a beautiful city. So. World War II, it survived the Golden Temple.
Do you know it was only by chance they survived?
Well, by chance, but...
Because the American president at the time chose not to bomb it based on historical...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So then the temple was wrapped in gold, but it's for tourists. And for him, that was an insult. Whether, like, it's kind of expressed in the book, but by reading the guy's biography, you just know... That pissed them off, innit? And so for him, the use of the building has changed spiritually and metaphorically. So for him, being burnt was probably the best thing for it.
Do you know what? I agree to some extent, but I also disagree. I feel like, for me, his relationship with the temple was tied up. It was interesting because I read it as the temple ended up basically being a physical symbolism of his idea of beauty, or his initial idea of beauty. But then as he like kind of goes through uni and the little course he's doing, he sort of explores this idea that beauty is actually impermanent and fleeting. And I think when he starts to explore that idea, he almost gets frustrated at how like permanent and unchanging the temple is, just there, like not just physically, but in his mind. It's always like whenever he has moments of ecstasy or sexual pleasure, it always comes back to the temple.
So why does it
and
switch?
I feel like, hold on a second, and I feel like his reason, or my thinking on the reason why he burnt the temple, was similarly when they talk about music being the highest art form, and saying that because when you play a note in the flute, it's there and it's gone in the same moment. And they speak about how that is beauty in these characters' eyes. And I feel like he almost, in burning it, he proves to himself that it can be beautiful, because it can be also impermanent, it can be destroyed. And I think in that destruction, he's basically
he made it beautiful,
weirdly making it beautiful, which is a warped way to see it.
Yeah,
but that's how I saw it.
To back that point, because I didn't see it that way, but to back that point, in the beginning, it does talk about how his obsession with the pavilion is based on his memory, his vivid memory of the thing. So his memory, I can imagine, is quite vivid, and so his, when he has moments, I don't know what the link is, but he's always relying on the memory of the beauty of the pavilion to kind of get him through moments, or to inspire him, or to make him angry, or to suggest some sort of emotion. But I think, to back your point, it's kind of like he's kind of used the pavilion in a way to kind of characterize his emotions. And the fact that, like you said, like he's burned it down, he said it's because of his memory. And like the last memory he's going to have of the pavilion is it being burnt down. So that maybe that's the new memory that will kind of invigorate him, because that's what people were needed.
And the memory isn't real in the same way that, for example, when you hear a piece of music, or you hear someone play a piece of music.
Yeah. Nostalgia, in a way, isn't it?
Like you
make it what you want.
You don't have an exact recording of that piece of music in your brain. You have a collection of essences of what the music
was. A souvenir.
And so he's now got a copy of what the beauty is of the temple based on his memory, but the physical version of it, which was kind of almost making it less beautiful because it was too real, he was allowed to explore it continually in his mind and have it be kept there and not exist anymore in the physical form, which in some ways made it like a musical note or whatever, like a musical thing.
So this is actually a good segue into what I wanted to speak about, because I thought the central thesis of the book for me was very much, as you said, I think you articulated it really well, that the beauty in the destruction and how it came to that conclusion, and this thing had to effectively be destroyed for it to be really appreciated. And it lent... So throughout this whole book, I kept thinking back to a conversation I had that with Kende a few years ago, about how in the West there's this like incessant need to preserve the past, whether it be historical artifacts. Let's say in Paris, this when the Notre Dame burnt down, and this outrage of a historical a building dying and disappearing, it needs to be rebuilt in exactly the same way, and we need to encapsulate this memory forever. And that's a very new thing. And this book goes against that, in that, which I think realistically nothing should really last forever, and this need to preserve the past, this need to preserve culture, is kind of unnatural, and that there's a beauty of things changing and disappearing, and a memory, the notes you sing, and or a piece of music is sung, but that affects, and those vibrations do translate into the world, and there is a mark there. It doesn't necessarily effectively remain static in time, but it's still there, it still lingers. And how now we kind of prevent that. If it was music, we would stick with one song and not allow that song to disappear or to never be sung again. It has to be sung, because we're so fixated on this need of preserving something, this need of keeping something the same. And the temple, the golden temple, the golden pavilion is kind of an example of that, where just like, oh wow, like what I wanted to ask was effectively, why do we do that? Why can't we be a bit like Mizu, I can't pronounce his name, the main character of this book, and why can't we just, like, let's say, okay, allow things to disappear, allow things to change, and allow, let's say, more of a focus of the present or the future, and that be our main point of interest culturally, socially, and culturally and socially. Why do we need this preservation of the past? Why can't we be a bit like the main character and like just let things burn? Is there beauty in things being destroyed? That's what I'm
thinking.
I think
we do to some extent need signposts of the past to like ground what we do in the present and the future. I think like that's kind of essential, but I don't know, I feel like we're in a pretty like irreverent culture moment now, where people have an understanding of the past, but it's more so used as a sort of sample for like mashing together whatever ideas from wherever you might take them and making something new. Like, I think especially with like the internet era or internet age, whatever you want to call it, it kind of allows for that constant destruction of like past ideals. And like, how often do you see on Twitter like something that might have been super respected at like you know, like a person or an idea just getting disregarded like it's nothing, and it's just like, oh, here's this new thing. It's like bang, like that's kind of where we're going with. I feel like that's weirdly, it's quite preemptive of an internet age, I feel like, this book, in terms of the possibility to just like tear stuff down without much of a, because he seems to be quite, he didn't have much respect for like authority or elder statesmen.
That came up over time though, didn't it? I guess.
What's that?
Like his respect for, because when he first started out and he was sweeping the grounds and he was doing this, and he had respect, and maybe not so much for his dad, he kind of did, but like he had his duties, right? But when he came to realize that his duties were, they were there before he even was even conscious of them, that's when he kind of was like, what am I doing with this? Do you know what I mean? But I guess back to Ruben's point about like, you know, this obsession with history, and I guess like obsession with keeping things the same. I guess like, I don't know how to kind of explain it, but like, especially in architecture with like London, especially, we can talk about UK, but when it comes to buildings, there has to be this kind of, you have to justify the building's character based on its context. So like, if there's like a really old villa, or like there's something really interesting nearby, you want to kind of appropriate that. And I guess some people might not like the word, but like essentially that's what it is. Like you're paying homage to it or referring to it in some sort of way with its like facade, like architecturally wise, like facade wise, whatever. And I guess that the whole point of that kind of notion in the planning process is to kind of keep an area alive and to suggest that something happened there. So for example, in West London, you know, Ladbroke Grove, you have all these like Georgian type of houses. Like you see, that poster up there, right? There's kind of windows and those houses in the background. That suggests like a type or an era in like UK kind of London, whatever. And it's quite interesting how that kind of Georgian townhouse is in the background of a rock kind of poster, because it's suggesting 60s, 70s, 80s kind of rock culture coming to life. But like that was in like West End, or it was like Ladbroke Grove. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of, the architecture speaks of the time. And similarly to this book, where for the character, this pavilion spoke to a time when Japan was before the Meiji era period, before the West came in over, when they lost the war, when they were banned from the Olympics, like commerce came and what's that white woman that everyone loved? Imagine Kim Kardashian, but like in like the 60s. What was her name?
Marilyn Monroe
went to Japan, right? This is when Japan was like, for Americans, was like the hot, like this is our new playing ground. Do you know what I mean? And so for him, he's like, he was reminiscent of the past. And again, back to your point about memory, we spoke about earlier, like memory is so key to, whether you want to agree or not, to people, like to us, like on a micro level, where we say our parents and grandparents and like where we're from, the food that we eat, all this kind of stuff, like we can talk about culture, but when it comes to like a nation, like being grounded in something means something. And when someone takes it from you, it feels like, you know, someone's taking it from you, it can be quite aggressive. And I feel like it's quite interesting in the book, because for him, the vulnerability of the pavilion, just sitting there, like, you know, this guy was plotting to burn it. Like, he's like, oh, the fire alarm went out and that was my perfect opportunity to take it out, but I didn't do it. And then he's like, oh, even the way he described, oh, the first match broke, or it was wet or something, the second match broke, and the third match lit, and then off it went. And is this kind of like, maybe there's beauty in vulnerability, and that's why I'm saying the book is rooted in this Buddha philosophy of like things come and go, and like, and it's kind of reflecting.
But why can't we be like that? I feel like you've given
explained it like I've explained about Christianity, like this is judgment, like fam, like people in robes, yeah, went to West Africa and said, this is Jesus Christ, your Lord and Savior, yeah, if you don't, then this is what we're doing right now, makes sense. We've read the book, bro, and how they kind of move things around to change a society, to change a mindset, to change people. It's like, this is good, this is bad.
I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying, why can't we be a bit like, have some Eastern philosophy I don't think we do. I think like you've given descriptions of, okay,
I'm talking about architecture that's around you, but has persisted. I'll give you an example of this poster we're looking at right now.
A constant preservation of that Georgian style this day, right?
Exactly. But I'm saying, why? The idea of it morphs all the time. I just told you about how it's like this kind of represents West London or this kind of Georgian thing, and there's all this like, this rock was kind of cool at the time, and people with the fucking mullets and whatever, and he's talking about East London. This is like, that's not why Jordan people did the building. Jordan was done because that is the style of building for rich people to build. I don't think Greenwich is full of it. Greenwich was like, if you had a port and you had West India Company, you had your ships on the Thames. If you wanted to go and do work, you went to the north, you went to a Shoreditch, which was sewers ditch, smelled like shit, and that's where they had all the bricks and the timber yards, whatever. If you had money, you'd go south to Greenwich, which you would play golf, and you go to Clapham, where you have a nice house. Well, I think Clapham, more than places, have Georgian houses, massive townhouses.
Right.
What I'm trying to say is, like, I can tell you that now, but the thing is, the representation of those houses now have changed. Like,
I'm
a bit confused, though.
Because I don't think, go on.
Like, I'm a bit confused as to whether that, I think one, your question is very open-ended, but two, I'm not sure if that addresses it in my head clearly. I don't know, maybe it's just me,
but that's the thing. What I think what I'm trying to say is, like, when it comes to an architecture style or like holding on to the past, it doesn't really mean shit. Because for example, I could the person who built that thing, like let's say Ground Zero, built the thing for a rich person, and like it's for them, they're playing, they're, like this is their mansion, do you know what I mean? But right now, you can go to Greenwich and you see them a Jordan massive townhouse. It's been chopped into flats. The golf course that used to be there is
why can't
black,
you why can't now, you, why can't you knock them out?
Hold on, let me land. It's now black. It's saying. Now Blackheath. Things change over time. Like,
okay,
our perception.
We create the meaning of them.
That's what I'm saying. Our perception of
in real time
of what we're seeing, is has changed. And like, for example, my friend from South Africa, she was saying. She likes, because she works here now, she's like, oh, I like kind of going around London sometimes because in South Africa, like, affluence is behind a fence. So for us to kind of have this, oh, why don't we have this kind of Eastern perception? Why don't we have it? That's a privilege. You don't understand. Like, having the ability to see architecture change, because normally that takes years, generations for something to change because people are, commit to something. There's a quote I read from a book. Let me just, this is the last thing I want to say. Last thing I want to say is like, oh, I can't remember who he said it. I think it was an architect. He said, the reason someone was like, oh, why don't we make like Gothic churches anymore? And the guy was like, because if you want to make a Gothic church, you have to commit to something. You have to be like, God is up there. We're gonna, this is yes and no. This is it. We live in a world where it's like yes, maybe it's political, blah, blah. And it's kind of we always shifting the line, and that's why we always have different so many different things. Kind of trolling along the way. People are trying to create meaning out of new things and divorce from things and start new things. And do you know what I mean? And so it's hard for, it's a privilege to see things change over time. But so at the same time, it's a curse because you can't commit, you can't feel grounded. Everything's plastic, it means nothing.
So from what I understand, you're saying that we do have a sense of like recycling. It just is a sense of recycling of meaning. In the sense that we do let things die, in a sense, in that, let's say, using Georgian housing, the idea, the use of Georgian housing now isn't the same use as it was in the past. And because it isn't like how it was in the past and it is being used differently, that in effect is letting things, something die, letting something dissipate. And
meaning
change.
Meaning can dissipate.
Yeah. And but what yeah, is I
meaning?
That. Okay,
meaning
I
doesn't mean shit. It doesn't mean shit. Because like you rationalize anything. It's like the temple, right? Like the temple, like I said, it was surrounded by people. It was visited every day by people. It was not gold, first of all. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Then it was made gold. And then, because that's what I'm saying, the guy, to the main character, he was like, the temple itself is dead. It's not even, I'm not even looking at the temple anymore. I'm looking at this thing that has been preserved.
A caricature of it.
It's plastic. It's like it has a new use. So for him, it didn't, it's vulnerability. It's kind of, I can just set this ablaze right now is the fun. Is the act of,
I don't know. It's also what makes it kind of psychopathic at the same time, because it's like, and I push back on your question a little bit because I think it's a bit general. It's a bit of a generalization to say that, you know, why can't we just be like them and stuff? Because we're not given any indication in this book that his way of thinking is a general way of thinking. It's very much, we just know that he thinks this way and that he's an outcast and that he's got like two friends, one friend that dies, one friend that's kind of like,
it's true,
in between. So it's like, because in the wider context, the rest of the acolytes are not necessarily like him in terms of how he thinks and how, you know, his kind of way.
So you're saying it's kind of wrong to look for some inspiration from his thoughts because they seem to be quite...
Yeah, it's almost like looking at the Joker and saying
No, it's true. That's a good
because there's a lot of similarities between him and like someone like a Joker kind of character where it's like
an anarchist.
Anarchist,
like,
but also
anti-hero.
He did look up to the anarchist, didn't he? He was kind of he's in the book, he was like, oh, he's an anarchist. And he kind of looked up to him a little bit. It was a bit weird.
But I felt like having read a little bit about the author, like, and his context and stuff, I think you almost feel like he's just, at times reading it, it's almost like you really get the author's voice shining through where it's like, he's just using the character to just get some thoughts off about random shit. Like, he would just go from talking about something and then it would just be like, and then you just feel his philosophy, author philosophy, just coming through the character, like, oh, you know, because this is what it means to be alive, and then philosophy is this. And it's just like, maybe the character's thinking all that stuff, but it's also, it feels quite...
There are some beautiful lines in there.
His hand in the main character's voice.
Yep, yeah.
It feels quite heavy, you know? Especially knowing what his own, like, personal ideas were on suicide, on whatever. It feels like he's very much exploring them just through the character.
Yeah, prodding them a bit.
Yeah.
And using, well, the prisoner in real life, but the protagonist in this book as a way, almost like a caveat, as like almost tempting those thoughts. Oh, what's that?
Yeah,
is that acceptable to do?
And ends up doing it in the end. Like, he ends up literally, but he didn't kill himself
in the book, and I don't think he did it.
Arsenic or something, isn't it?
Yeah, that was
it flirts with it. It's almost right. Like, is he gonna stab himself?
That's why I was so confused with this book, because it makes sense that he kills himself at the end.
Does it?
Why? Because he's flirting with this idea for the whole time. He's providing a level of justification. The world is broken. There's this sense, this beauty in death, in destruction, and the ultimate beauty, the ultimate sacrifice of killing myself would be this. I'd be at one with this beauty that I'm seeking. My life is terrible, all of this, and I need destruction. So. He doesn't do that. He goes against that, and the book's like him satisfied with him burning the temple, and he's happy now. And it's like, you've just gone against your philosophy. There's a lot of contradictions, and that's why, even to this moment, I'm so confused. I'm so confused by this book, and it's broken my brain in a way, in a sense that my brain doesn't work in that same process. Throughout this book, from page to page, it's contradicting itself, and it is the mind of a madman in a way,
but also not like,
but,
I think,
but the man, but the no, mind no, no, of beauty, a man.
Let me land. Let me land. I meant in the sense of you're not a madman, and that a lot of our inner thoughts, our inner monologue, is incredibly irrational, nonsensical at times. Doesn't actually really follow a set linear like narrative. It jumps from place to place to place. And I think it's masterful how, as an author, he encapsulates that. I think you just said something really telling at the beginning of the podcast, where you said it's very easy to write a sane character than it is to write an insane one. It's very true. He masters this, where you left feeling uneasy and confused, but that's a personal, a mind of someone who isn't all there. And if you get that, and you don't, writing in a way like stuttering and like doing in a way where that's incredible. See, how he's been
the
able reason to
I
do
brought
that.
That up at the beginning, but we can't expand on it, because I feel like the writer's trying to convey the point that he is actually just a normal guy. If they wanted to make him disabled, as you want to put it, like really wanted to make him show that he is incapable of doing things, he would have done that. But the point, I think. Maybe the point of the book is like to not stutter the dialogue, is to deliberately make us, the readers, know that this guy is just a guy with a stutter. And like you were saying, right? Like having all the words in your head but unable to bring it externally is a pain. Like it's a hindrance. But it doesn't make you any less of a human being or a man. It's and true. Doesn't Very make true. You more insane. And the thing is, if I can imagine, even speaking for myself, if someone was to write a book about the thoughts in my head, right? It would just be as chaotic.
That's what I'm saying.
As this book.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Do you get it? And so, like, I feel like, and that's what I'm saying, the philosophy side is so important here, because Western philosophy is like, time is linear. It goes from A to B. It's a line. But Eastern philosophy is like, time is secular. Like, we die, we born again, or whatever. I don't read it, so I don't know, but like, it's not linear. I know for sure, like, they definitely see time as secular. Like, life is a circle, it's wholesome, it has a beginning and the end, but not in the same way we have, you know, Marvel is like A to B, like this, and there's branches and shit. Well, it's not like that. Like, Eastern philosophy is very different. So for us to kind of commend his writing style because of his upbringing is one thing. It's like when the first time you watch a Mary Garvey film, or you watch Spirit, when the first time I watched Spirited Away, or like Princess Mononoke, I'm like, I've never watched a film like this before. Like Princess Mononoke, when you're watching a film, you know there's normally a bad guy. Do you know what I mean? There's normally evil, and it's like boom. But like anime doesn't do that. It's very different. And that's why it's probably so compelling, because that's not the type of writing we're used to, or the rhythm we're used to.
Yeah, but also, just to clarify, just like kind of on your point as well, he's, even though he does have an impediment with his speaking, his thoughts are all coherent and they're all like fluent. It's not like he's thinking in a stutter. He just has a stutter when he speaks. And you often actually don't even... so much so that sometimes you can forget that he even has one. That's because it's just we're so in his head that you aren't really aware.
Yeah,
a lot of the time.
Because I'm saying Flowers of Algernon, Clockwork Orange, they're in the dialogue, they're chopping every word.
When but that when works they get for those books. Those, you can't make that's those comparisons.
But my point is like, if you want to do it, you can.
No, I don't think you can.
Why not?
In a sense that this book is an exploration of a singular character with his and him interacting with the world around him. Whereas
Flowers of Algernon was what then?
Flowers of Algernon. It's a bit like that. Don't get me wrong. I put my hands up. That's very true. It's a bit like that. But it's chronicling his experiences with, let's say, the external world, the world, him and external world, but also it is chronicling the external world too. Like,
but you see the difference in the books.
Whereas with Clockwork Orange too, it's
language, but like ultimately
the language is essential. Important for the
that's
book.
That's fine, but like they didn't have to do that if they didn't want to. Like,
no, it's true, but it adds to the book.
That was a bad example, but definitely this, Flowers for Algernon, it shows a Western perception. It shows
that's a good example.
The outside world is inflicted on me. Mm. How do I deal with it? This is more of like, this is life, and I'm open to it. And like, your perception isn't down to.
I would say scrutiny. Flowers of Algernon isn't good because it's more linear. So it's chronicling a beginning, middle, and end. Whereas this book doesn't even really have it has a beginning, middle, and end, but it's so odd.
Which is a good thing. Yeah, but which I learned to appreciate.
I think it's more circular. The end feels like a beginning. Do you understand? It ends, but it's not an ending. It's a beginning because he's finished. But you're not finished. It's almost like he's started, he's found a truth. And in Western literature, it'd be like, okay, this is the truth. And is this truth real or not? Is this the end?
Jay Brown's dream. He killed somebody at the end, yeah?
Yeah.
At the end, it was like, he's going to prison. And now my man, who the main character, his name? David. I can't remember now. The main character now has... He's now gone off to do his own thing, but he's clearly mourning, right? So it's like this kind of clear emotions of where this is going. This book, you don't have that.
I don't, bro.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
because I think I'm going.
You're trying to cling onto the character, and I couldn't find him for ages. So I said, you know what? I'm just gonna read it, like kind of blindly, but just read it and just kind of go through it. And then after a while, it kind of. How to explain it? It filled me up slowly. If that makes sense. You know, when you're just drinking tea, kind of like night, like it's slowly. This is not normally we're used to drinking shots. Do you know what I mean? There's a different pace to it.
Do you know what? This is why I like this book. I like this book. Okay, cool. I like this book because I just feel fucking. It just made me feel super, super uneasy. It's made me feel really fucking up to this day. Like, it makes me feel so uncomfortable. I don't know why. I'm trying to speak to my friend. It's like, oh, I'm reading this book. I keep asking people, have you read The Temple of Golden Pavilion? It's like, no, I've never heard of it. It's like, oh, okay. I just need, because I wanted to hear what someone thought about it to maybe even frame how I thought about it. But even listening to you guys, I thought, okay, you know what? When I get to this podcast, let me listen to Zach and Kende because I don't know what to think about. So I'm just going to stay silent for a bit and just listen to what. And you both had that kind of sense, that same feeling. So now I'm like, Maybe was that the intention of the book? Was it? Maybe, was it me?
Great art does that to you, where it does create like
no. But when you read, whenever we read Toni Morrison, and I'm not gonna lie, Toni Morrison, in terms of writing style, everything is like the pinnacle. No, that's why you. No. And but you still you're left with like an understanding of that literature.
But it's something that we're more accustomed to, like that still comes from a Western canon that we're accustomed to. Whereas I feel like this is like, it's like in music. There's a Western classical scale, which we're used to, like A, B, C, D, whatever. And then the Eastern scale, which is a different, entirely different composition of notes that have entirely different possibilities in terms of how you hear them, that don't even apply, that you can't apply the same structures or frameworks of how you think about listening to a tune from the West and the East. And it's like, this book kind of does that, and I think it's a good jolt actually out of the rhythm that we normally of books, where we'd read like books that. And it would be like, okay, you know, you would be looking for certain things that are familiar, da, da, da. But I feel like this is what I think it is, genuinely genius. Even though I didn't enjoy reading it, I think it's genius because it does that kind of, it's just provocative. Like, it's provocative. It's, like, it is actually provocative in a way that I think I think it's good. Like, it's good to kind of explore something that does that in that kind of way, and kind of just gives you so much. I don't know. I would read this again. I can't lie. Like, I'd read it again.
How would you rate the book then?
Shall I go first? Yeah.
Yeah.
I would give this book, I'm going to say a 9.5. I'll be honest.
Wow, that's very high.
9.5, and
that's incredible.
Because honestly,
that's biased.
It does. It does, yeah. What it does is what I'm personally attracted to in art anyway, which is not an attempt to kind of overly guide you into a conclusion, but it offers an exploration of something in detail that both allows you to look at the miniature and the magnificent. And I feel like that's what he does in this book. And I think for me, my personal taste of what I like to see and experience is part of that. And for me, 9.5. I was going to say 10, but let me just relax.
I have to say, that's probably the best.
No, say 10. Say 10.
That is the best review I've ever had. He said the miniature and the magnificent. That is mad.
No, bro. Would you say it's a 10? Be brave.
No.
Be brave if it's a 10.
No. 9.5 because I didn't enjoy it, but I've also realised that I did actually think it's incredible.
And you'd recommend it?
That's absolutely so funny.
Yeah.
What about you, Kende?
I'm gonna go for an 8. I'll just say an 8 because I'm like, I can't lie. When I was reading it, I was like, this is getting like a 6 or 7, because what I clung to was the pace, and I thought when I realized that the pace wasn't changing, I was like, I'm gonna hit something, something's gonna escalate. And obviously the juicy parts came towards the end, but ultimately I just learned to kind of, and I learned more about the writer. I learned that he's not gonna give me cheat codes or anything. It's just, this is what it is, and that's like, it was quite a new experience, to be honest. It was quite painful, and as you can say, as a Western reader, but it was rewarding in a way, because at the end I was able to reflect on it, hopefully. And normally when I read a book, I'm like, I underline stuff and like quotes and stuff, but this one I kind of just said, there's quite a lot in here, let me not stop, let me just keep reading it. So what I did do, if I'm honest, I read a lot of it. And I think I was 2 chapters in the middle, I think it was chapter 6. I did an audiobook for, because I was at work, I just listened to my headphones. And then the rest of the time, like from like 7, 8, and 9, 10, I just did all and read it again in the book. So I did have a bit of a change from it, but I think the audiobook kind of gave me another perspective, which was quite nice. Which I don't tend to use audiobooks, but when I do use them, I kind of prefer to use them on like the lower quartile of the time, if that makes sense, like less of the time, because I feel like when it's all of it, I kind of don't get the story, but that's just my opinion. That's just my preference. But like I said, I gave it an 8 because I think there's a lot in that. And I don't know if I would read it this year, maybe not even next, but like 2025 maybe. There's something in that. Yeah. Ruben, what do you think?
Honestly.
Bro, I'm struggling. It's for me, it's not less than a seven. Not less than seven. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of writing style, we always also have to remember this is a translation, as I keep saying, that if you want the real essence of the book, you have to read it in the language it was written in. But even then, it's still really beautifully written. I loved that analysis of writing a character from a less sane perspective is incredibly hard to do, and perfection. This book has perfected that. And if you are looking for a book to get into a mind of someone who has schizophrenia or traits of schizophrenia, mental illness, or whatever, then this is a book for you, as well as just a book that's not, as you said, a Western canon that I feel like all podcasts, all British podcasts, all English podcasts always like focus on like Western literature, where the world is much bigger than that. So I think an 8.5. Do you know what? 9.
You gave it a 9 and you didn't even know, you didn't understand it.
No, do you know why I give it a 9? Because I'm going on the likelihood of me saying, oh, you should read this book to someone.
Mm.
And it's in the same levels as Beloved that I've been, that was like my 9.5, 10. Flowers for Algernon is the only 10 I've given. I've been saying that. And those are the only two books from what we've read out of the
you know,
and like, this, and I'm going to say this is the third one that I'll probably be saying you need someone needs, you should read this
book is like an album where you don't understand it at first, but you know that there's something in it that you need,
it's going to take me a good 6 months.
Remember the photographer's gallery, and you're like, oh, the book, I was like, don't say anything,
yeah,
because I can't, like, I wanted to say something like, oh, I don't like the book, but I was like to myself, I actually haven't read enough to know anything. So that's why I was like, let's not talk about it. Because I don't want, like, my thoughts to fleet. Because I just hadn't... You know, you listen to an album first once, and people are like, what do you think? I'm like, I don't know yet.
Do you know what's...
You just don't know
yet. Do you know what's like for me?
You don't know.
It's like Solange's second album, where people didn't get it. People are like, I don't get it. And I read it, I listened to it, I was like, I don't get it, but I know it's beautiful. I know this is...
I think it's more divisive than that.
It's a great...
So. Same.
You think it's more divisive?
I think so.
More divisive.
Well, that album was very divisive because everyone was expecting it to be a certain way. But then you listen to it now and there's masterful songs.
The way Zach explained it earlier is about how it kind of like... It latched onto him. It kind of... it stayed with him for a bit, and then as it stayed on him, it grew even more. It was weird. I had the same kind of experience. I finished the book.
Do you know what it feels like? Yesterday. It feels like a leech,
but it's not sucking. It's not sucking.
It just feels uncomfortable.
I feel like it clung onto me, and then it clung to me, and it kept growing because I thought about it more. And
I don't know how to. I struggle with the analogies because it's very normally I'm really good with analogies, but this is. I don't even, it's so novel in itself. That's why I have to say it's a 9.5 because...
Oh, you're going up again?
No, I said 9.5.
Okay, cool.
Oh, I said 9, sorry. Say 9.
You said 9, yeah.
No.
It's weird to give a book, I can't lie. It's weird to give a book anything more than 8.
It's 9.
If you don't enjoy the writing, can't lie.
No, the writing, I enjoyed, that's what I'm saying. I didn't have any issues with the writing stuff. The writing stuff was very good.
I can't lie. It's not top 5. Best.
It's not top five, but I'm giving.
I think it is. I think it's top 3.
I think that's what I'm saying.
It's better than Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange was written in 2 weeks.
That's conceptual.
Clockwork Orange was written in 2 weeks, and it's still that's a lot in itself.
That's a publicity standard. I think it's better than
Flowers, personally.
But, no. Flowers, you can't. That.
No.
Flowers for Algernon for me was like that's a 10. But this book for me, Flowers for Algernon, Beloved, and this top 3 books of the podcast for me, in my eyes, and all for different reasons. Flower for Algernon because it's personal touch to me. I think it's beautifully written.
No,
it's very personal.
It's not compared too much. It's compared to much.
And Beloved, I say they're all different in their own regards. I'm not even making comparisons.
He's just in his opinion.
Yeah, Beloved was great. Like just a master of this is how you write a book. This is the book.
I don't buy that. But with this,
it's like. What is it like? How would I define it?
To the bias, how we read books.
This is why you should read it. But as well as the exploration of a character, the narrative, the all of it is beautiful. I think it's great. That's what I'm saying. I feel like as I'm recounting reading this book, it's just like, okay, yeah, it's a good book. I'll say it's a 9. I'm sticking with that. That was the first number that popped into my head.
Fine. Fair enough. Okay, cool.
Oh, it's my turn for a book.
Before we end, I just want to ask. So, what's your top three, Zach? Then,
like, so far,
books seasons. That we've read.
Yeah, books that we've read.
I would say in no order.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Tina Fey.
This me. Tina Fey, I absolutely say
off,
that.
Really?
Seriously? Yeah. And probably Sula.
Not Beloved.
No,
Sula was better than Beloved.
Really,
Beloved was holding your hand, and also it was Beloved, weird.
Yeah, it was a bit.
It was the writing was. It was not. It was all over the place. Anyway,
how about you?
I was a fan. I listened to all the book.
Just to end. Top three to end.
Top three to end.
I need to do the book.
I can't lie. No particular order. Giovanni's Room for me.
Is it?
No, I don't know. The writing for me was actually.
You like that too?
How about Things Fall Apart? Because that was an incredible Ooh. Book. That was a good ass book.
Best ending so far.
Yeah, best ending 100%.
Nothing's comparable in the ending. The ending
just that zoom out. Yeah, it's cold. It was just another day, like another Tuesday.
That's cold. The best ending of any book I've ever read in my life.
Maybe. But okay. Giovanni's Room, because of the writing. I think the writing was actually, it was so good. I Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Mm.
I really fucked with that book. I can't lie. Because I would have never picked up any, and I really enjoyed it. And I loved it when he went guns blazing towards the end. I was thinking, yo, man, yeah, let's do this. Do you know what I mean? Like, I enjoyed that book. And also, third one. I want to say Sula, but I feel that's a cop out. I do feel like that reminds me. I don't know. There's quite.
Oh, that reminds me, is it?
Sorry,
No.
Be brave.
Do you know? I feel like. I don't know. Maybe I'm lying to myself.
Just be honest. Last be honest.
One. No, I'm thinking. Last one.
There's a few now, actually.
That's what I'm saying. I do think Sula was good.
Okay, fair.
I'll sit with that. And I feel like it was a bit of a cop out, but I could have replaced it. But I do. When I was reading that, I couldn't put it down. Because that was a book that I couldn't put down. I just couldn't. I was reading it walking. I was like, bro.
I think Beloved was better. Sula was great. Beloved.
No, Beloved was like Beloved ridiculous. The whole ghost thing. Some of it didn't make sense.
No, if you listen, the audiobook was.
Oh, well, see, that's what I'm saying.
Also, I think there has to be a distinction made between experiencing a reading and experiencing an audiobook. It's a different.
No, I've read it and it was both incredible. That's why I listened to audiobook.
Which one did you do first?
Read it.
Yeah, you definitely skipped
it. If you did audiobook first and you read the book, it's not the same experience. Yeah. I cannot lie to you.
Fair.
You have to read the book, bro.
All right, my book. I'm going to do...
No, what are your top three?
I've already said Beloved, Flowers of Algernon, and this. I think this is my top three. Even though I've recommended Things Fall Apart for the ending, and a lot of people that I think need to know the impacts of colonialism. But it just encapsulates the impacts of colonialism.
It was deeper than that, but yes.
No, it's deeper, but it's... The ending is so important. Never forgot, guys. But yeah, so the last book, I think this is the 12th book, so it's technically the end of the season. Lol. Oh, was that the end of the season? I don't even know, man. The season's been going on for
just
2 years, mate.
Land,
but yeah,
land
book, so okay, pop science book or. A literary classic.
Choose, bro.
All right, you know what? I'm gonna do, because I'm gonna mix up a bit, because we've been reading quite heavy books. Why Is Sex Fun by Jared Diamond. Cool. It's a small book. Well, I kind of wanted to pick a big book because I'm going away. I'm gonna need something to read in the book beach. I was gonna pick June, but I thought that's too big for you guys. You won't need something small.
No, just pick a book. What's the book? Do
Why Is Sex Fun by Jared Diamond.
Is it non-fiction? Or is it a fiction book?
No, it's a pop science book.
What's that?
Pop science book.
Yeah, popular science book. So it's like scientific concepts that have
it's
been
not like
written.
A
that have been written in a
scholarly
no, written it's a very it gives an explanation like no. from a scientific context. No, it's just a blurb, isn't it? Of why sex is fun from human
It's in one of your lectures you went to.
No, it's a very famous book, and it was actually on my list.
All right, cool.
And I thought it'd be good, because it could be good practice for me to teach you guys about
skiing.
Okay, anyway, so basically, we're done. Fucking.
So you got a PhD.
Your room is in Hinge again, bro.
No. Hopefully this will have some.
No, it's. I think we need a bit of a curveball too. Well. Oh. I was gonna do Devil's Wear Prada. I was gonna pick Devil's Wear Prada.
Okay.
But yeah.
Cool.
That's it.
Sounds good.
I lingered on a bit. Peace. See you guys later.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Nanga Death.